Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1971, Richard Nixon declared drug abuse as, quote, public enemy number one in the United States, end quote. This is rarely talked about, but during the Nixon era, for the first time in history and the only time in the history of the war on drugs, the majority of funding went towards treatment rather than law enforcement. But that quickly changed with tough-on-crime rhetoric from both Republicans and Democrats. And here we are today, 40 years later, and the war on drugs has cost $1 trillion and has led to 45 million arrests. With only 5% of the world's population, the U.S. holds 25% of its prisoners. Over 500,000 are incarcerated for nonviolent drug crimes, which has damaged mostly poor communities across the country. And the majority of those who are locked up for drug offenses are Black men. The documentary, The House I Live In, puts a face on the drug war by capturing heart-wrenching stories from individuals at all levels of America's war on drugs. The filmmaker Eugene Jarecki examines how political and economic corruption have fueled this war for 40 years, despite persistent evidence of its moral, economic, and practical failures. Eugene Jarecki is an award-winning writer and director. He has twice won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, first in 2005 for Why We Fight, and again in 2012 for this film, The House I Live In. And Eugene joins us from New York. Hi, Eugene. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, you have such a wide range of interests. Your other films include Reagan, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, and Freakonomics. And I loved your book that came out about 4 or 5 years ago, The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and A Republic in Peril. What drew you to this topic, to focus, you know, so much of your time on the war on drugs?
Well, it's the most personal topic to me of all the movies I've made and the subjects I've attended to. And I think that largely came out of my own life experience. There was sort of a coming together of forces in my life. On the one hand, I'm a child of refugees who escaped Nazi Germany and came to America trying to seek our better freedoms, and saw in the struggle of poor people, particularly Black people in America, a kind of sister struggle to the Jewish struggle in Europe. So I come out of a long history of Jewish progressivism that sees a very strong bond between the Jewish experience of suffering and the Black American experience of struggle and suffering. So there was that. And then on the other hand, growing up in the early 1970s, I just happened to have grown up at a time when this sort of new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander has called it, emerged in the form of the drug war. We're right at the end of the civil rights movement, when all of us would have hoped to see a better America take a step forward. Instead, we saw a new set of obstacles placed before Black America to thwart Black American progress. And as I was growing up, I just saw that firsthand. I was friends with many people, and I had family in extended ways throughout the African American community, where young people who'd been my playmates growing up, they were not, you know, going off to an Ivy League school like I got to do and going to a fancy high school and going to have all this opportunity laid before them. They were having lives of continued obstacle, struggle, and dismay. And the question was why? And that ultimately led me to an investigation that led to the war on drugs.
And what's interesting is in the film, you speak to a number of people about the war on drugs, and they don't really know much about it. And I was just reading your Twitter feed for this documentary, and so many people who've seen the film say, I had no idea this was even happening. Right. So is it safe to say that even though we have so many people in prison, I mean, part of the problem is the prisons are far away from the big city, so we don't even really see them on a regular basis. But
right.
People
Those
don't
are
really...
silent people.
Right.
They're silenced by that.
Yeah. So did that surprise you that so many people don't really know about this?
Well, I'll tell you what, the bad news and the good news. The bad news is when we started the film, it was astonishing to me how few people knew what the war on drugs was. I'd say I was making a film about the war on drugs, and they'd say, oh, in Mexico, or oh, in Afghanistan, not realizing that the epicenter of the drug war itself is here in America, with then a ricochet effect, a kind of ripple effect out into Mexico, out into Afghanistan. No less grotesque, no less harrowing for those societies, but it begins here at home, and nobody was really doing the math on that. The good news is everybody knows about it now. Ever since we made this this film, and I think the film contributed to this, but it's just one element in the large movement against the war on drugs, and it's a tool that people have come to use. But the movement against the war on drugs has gained an incredible amount of ground, most recently, of course, apparently winning the heart of the Attorney General, who's really changing America's laws. The war on drugs is history already as we speak. It is already changing so profoundly that the question now is, how do we take it to the next level and really turn this into the public health mission that it always should have been?
And it's so interesting because you go back in history, which I really appreciate, and you focus on the fact that while Nixon did declare drug use as public enemy number one, he actually focused on treatment rather than law enforcement. And I don't think that's widely known.
No, it's one of those things. I mean, one day somebody's going to write a great big apology to Richard Nixon, and it should be with great caveats, because Richard Nixon has his tremendous flaws, as we know. But what's interesting, it's not interesting where Nixon is a savage and a primitive and a reprobate. That's obvious. We already know the tapes. The interesting stuff is where Nixon is cool. And strangely, Nixon was cool on the drug war, but only so cool. He was cool in the following way. When he was in office, the fact is, as you say, he spent the majority of his drug budget on treatment and not on law enforcement. And he understood the value of his methadone clinics, and he understood the value of treatment as a serious form of a response to the drug issue. At the same time, and this actually speaks even worse of him, so here's, it turns out, a compliment with an undertow. It turns out that what he did was, he learned in 1968 that when he ran as a public figure for president, he was really the first candidate to make crime a national issue for the first time. And it was an incredibly winning strategy, and he was a crime warrior. And in many ways, with American cities having their difficulties, that was seen as very popular. And Nixon really sort of casts the mold of talking tough on crime gets you elected. So then he becomes a president, and as president, it turns out he has rather progressive policies about addiction, and he's dealing with some very high-level, high-minded thinking people about drug addiction within his own cabinet, very smart people. And yet, 4 years later, when 72 rolls around, out comes the tough-on-crime rhetoric again, as if nothing ever happened, as if he wasn't actually a reasonable-minded guy as president. So what you can say of him is even worse. Nixon knew better, and nonetheless positioned himself to sound tough on crime. Well, what happened after that was that generations of policymakers have just walked with the tough on crime rhetoric and have abandoned the actual substance of his more reasoned policymaking.
We're speaking with Eugene Jarecki, award-winning writer and director of the film The House I Live In. And let's play a clip that focuses on this piece of history. And in this clip, you'll hear a number of voices, including Charles Bowden, who we've had on this show. He does really great work on the war on drugs. Mark Maurer, Sentencing Project. Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow. And David Simon, producer of the excellent series The Wire. And here's a clip from The House I Live In.
The U.S. war on drugs was initiated officially under President Richard Nixon to get his polls up.
For most people I talk to, the drug war as we know it today was born in the late 60s and early 70s under Richard Nixon.
I have no sympathy for the pushers and the peddlers and the others in this country.
We are going to restore freedom from fear in America again.
When Nixon ran for president in 1968, he talked about the problem of crime in the streets.
The wave of crime is not going to be the wave of the future in the United States of America.
And this is really the first time in a major way that the issue of drug crime became a national political issue.
Richard Nixon is credited as the first to coin the term a war on drugs. But what most people don't realize is that under Richard Nixon, two-thirds of the drug war budget was devoted to treatment rather than law enforcement.
Because a program of law enforcement alone is not enough.
Well, Nixon actually had some forward thinking in the war on drugs. He understood the need to address addiction.
This means that on the treatment of addicts, we must go parallel.
And he actually did some things that were progressive, certainly by standards of what came after him.
You know, you don't turn to drugs unless you can't find satisfaction another way in your own life.
The more I learned about Nixon, the more confusing he became. Privately, he knew that he'd been far more successful with drug treatment than with law enforcement. But publicly, as the 72 election approached, Nixon returned to the simple crime-fighting rhetoric that had worked for him before.
We must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one in the United States, the problem of dangerous drugs.
Nixon wins re-election in a landslide victory.
And that is a clip from the documentary The House I Live In, which puts a face on the drug war by capturing heart-wrenching stories from individuals at all levels of this war. And we're speaking with Eugene Jarecki, director of the film. And you know, what happened, Eugene, when two-thirds of the budget was devoted to treatment? What did that look like?
Well, what we saw was methadone clinics. We saw other interventionary health-based approaches to, at the community level, to dealing with addiction in a constructive way. You know, when you criminalize addiction, something like that, it's kind of like declaring war on terror. You know, it's one of these things that's bound to backfire because you've declared an amorphous enemy. And by doing that, you do more to empower yourself as the aggressor than you do to really write a prescription for reform. You know, by criminalizing drug activity, let's just take it in this case. You know, a young kid here in New York gets stopped on the street for marijuana under a ridiculous stop and frisk regime that exists here. And now they've got a little strike on their record, which makes it now so that maybe they'll spend a little time in jail or maybe they'll just get a slap on the hand. But one way or another, they get the mark on their record. That now means they have trouble getting a job. If they have trouble getting a job, they're now going to be far more likely to find it lucrative to operate in a cottage economy, in the underground economies that will have them. And so the next time, they're going to get an even bigger strike and a bigger strike. And before long, life in and out of the criminal justice system becomes the norm for them. And what you've done is take a nonviolent, lost young person. How many of your listeners tried marijuana at 13, 14? And now you turn each of those people into a criminal. You criminalize people who were always nonviolent. So now you're taking nonviolent people and criminalizing them indiscreetly from the violent, putting them into prisons alongside violent people so that when those prisons go into lockdown, for example, these young people are smoldering in a locked condition with the people who become their new mentors and parents and guides in life. And those are inveterate criminals who, for one reason or other, are more on the violent side. And so now you're watching people get criminalized through that activity, and they come back out and there's no jobs for them, and the lure remains. And of course, all the way along, they had an addiction which never got treated. And so the country's spiraling levels of addiction were left unaddressed while we criminalized a population and made them far more prone to take on new addictions as we go. This is a self-licking ice cream cone. It's a business that, of course, wants it that way because that means an insurance policy that you will keep having more and more people fill those very lucrative prison beds.
And you point out that over the course of the war on drugs, 40 years, illegal drug use has remained unchanged.
Yeah. Yeah. And if anything, you know, I mean, I think the real fact here is that we have the most draconian laws in the world and we have the highest levels of demand in the world. We could not have failed more utterly on every front. But the good news is the conversation about the failure of the war on drugs is already a fait accompli. Even the attorney general recognizes that the drug war has failed in the new laws that the new sort of practices within the Justice Department that he's sent out across the country and in the way the Obama administration has made clear that they intend not to interfere with Washington and Colorado as two example states having legalized marijuana across the board. Once the federal government is blessing states to move forward with the legalization of marijuana, at the very minimum that marijuana, which is the engine by which most people get stuck in the criminal justice system, that is beginning to end, and therefore I can tell you the drug war itself is beginning to end. The question now is we cannot let down our guard because we have a national drug issue that needs a public health response. And if we don't give it a public health response, the levels of addiction will remain and grow, and we will now find ourselves in a position where we have an irresponsible government washing its hands of the mistake it made, but not stepping in with the kind of constructive approach that should have been there all along.
How do you see this playing out? Because it's fascinating to watch states like Texas really take this on in a way like states like California are not. And you hear a lot of Republicans talking about how this war has failed. And of course, the libertarians have always been so consistent, more consistent than Republicans or Democrats on this. But how do you see it playing out? Because I often hear Republicans talk about it based on how much it costs rather than the moral and the ethical questions like public health. So what happens to these people whose lives have been completely ruined by this if things really do change?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that happens, and we see this, for example, in California with Prop 36. Prop 36 was a major development on Election Day where the voters of California, overwhelmingly more than 60% of California voters, voted changed the three strikes law in California to make it less severe than it had been for some 20 years. And prior to Election Day, you would go to jail for the rest of your life for a third strike, even if that strike was petty or nonviolent, like stealing a slice of pizza in one famous case, or a pack of gum, a tube of denture cream got another person a life sentence. This was so ridiculous that for 20 years it cried out for reform because it makes no common sense. And finally, this past Election Day, when Obama got reelected, the California voters change that law. Now, what is the effect of that? Not only will fewer people coming down the pike receive three strikes, life imprisonment sentences for petty offenses, but it also was given a reach-back power to go back into people whose lives had already had that done to them, and they would now have their sentences revisited based on time served, good behavior, and the rest. So this has a practical implication on people's lives. What I think your questions, and a great one in that sense, any of these reforms, any of pulling back an out-of-control, absurd, runaway, profit-making corruption like this will help people's lives because they are the victims. The prison industrial system in America, it feeds on human life for profit. So when you slow it down, human lives suffer less. So that's just math. The question I think that's implied by what you're asking, though, is they've already had their lives so damaged. Now what? Are there reparations? Is there going to be a system of approach that tries to now redress not just the error of the drugs themselves and the impact they might have had on the person? Can we have a public health system? But could we add to that some sort of truth and reconciliation mechanism that would say, look, we've been bad as a country. We didn't deal with this right. You needed something other than what we gave you. And in fact, we dealt you some very devastating blows. Good luck. This country doesn't look kindly on the idea of reparations because it's easy to malign that as some sort of welfare program.
Mm-hmm. Eugene Jarecki is writer and director of the documentary The House I Live In. It's about the history and impact of the war on drugs in the United States. 500,000 people are incarcerated for nonviolent drug crimes, which has damaged mostly poor communities across the country. And we'd love to hear from you if you've been directly affected by this war on drugs, this trillion-dollar war on drugs. Share your story. And then if you work in the prison industry or if you work with rehabilitation or any programs that work with young people, what changes do you expect in the coming years? Because this is really getting so much more attention now than it has ever before. And people across the board are calling for major reform. So how do we actually get there? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Eugene, you filmed in more than 20 states and you met so many people, grieving moms, drug dealers, narcotics officers, senators, people who work inside prisons who are questioning this system. What do you know today that you didn't know then? I mean, what really kind of shocked you or surprised you or just really affected you in this process?
Sure. I mean, there's no way to describe the shock you feel when you do the math, a prison door closes behind you, and you get a brief moment of you get a tiny glimpse into the massive sensation that has to dawn on a person whose freedom has been taken away for any reason, but especially for a nonviolent crime that should never have been a crime. It was a nonviolent act that in which a person took a mind-altering or person-altering substance. The idea that the government had any role in that is astonishing to begin with. And when you hear the door slam behind you, the shock of such a premise for incarceration dawns on you, on top of the shock of man's inhumanity to man, that the best we've come up with, having put a man on the moon and invented the iPhone, is to lock a person in a box when they've been bad. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing that Freud and the rest of modern psychiatry and the rest of the development of the understanding of the species has led us to think that's productive. So all of that shock is profound, but maybe not surprising, because you would think, as if you have a compassionate heart, you would think that no creature warrants such treatment, and you'd feel that way if the door closed, and you do. So that's not surprising. What's surprising, I think, is the degree to which nobody comes out of central casting. For the first minute or two, most of the people you see, a prisoner looks like a prisoner and looks like they're, you know, scary and brooding and tattooed and very alienating. And you see a prison guard and he looks like he just came from eating his young and he's going to hang you up in a cell somewhere and lock you up and throw away the key. But that invariably, a couple of minutes into any conversation, there's just this common humanity that emerges. And not just a common humanity, So there's a common humanity everywhere. I can find compassion for almost anybody. And I've noticed in my life how much, if you let the prejudices that we're programmed with fall away and you take yourself back to being a kid on the schoolyard who's got that innocence toward others that kids especially have, that almost anybody can reveal things to you that are endearing about them. Even the most hardened looking criminal, the most hardened looking security chief, the hardened warden, the hardened prosecutor, the hardened judge, I can find my heart with those people almost at all times because their rhetoric and their posturing is usually just how they keep their job or how they impress their girl or how they impress their friends or what they think their ego needs. And if you take a bit of a Buddhist approach to it, you see a suffering inside the person that's manifesting itself in some insecure behavior. So I can get all that. But the surprising part is that it's not just a common humanity that emerges in the prison industrial system, because everybody is living such a larger-than-life life. So many of these people have a larger-than-life kind of humanity. You know, a security chief of the prisons in Oklahoma told me things so startling critically about the war on drugs, and he did so at the peril of his own job. He did so standing in uniform in a prison, comparing what he and the others are doing to Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. I had police officers sit in the front seat of their patrol car and question the very thing they do each day, day in, day out, arresting the same people over and over for what gain in the community. And then you could see the forlorn sort of disillusionment in their eyes, and that they would share it with me so openly was tremendously, majestically human, that they would take such risk and that they'd be so self-reflective. A judge from his chambers telling me how incredibly wrong-headed the drug war is, how it ties his hands as a judge, strips this court system of the wisdom of judges to determine sentencing, and instead it's determined by prosecutors who really are just carrying out the tough-on-crime laws that Congress people passed so they could get elected and sound tough. At all levels of the system, I found tremendous courage and therefore tremendous human majesty trapped within the grip of this very dehumanizing system.
Eugene Jarecki is writer and director of The House I Live In, a documentary about the history and impact of the war on drugs in the U.S. And let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Richard in Monterey. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good day. Thank you for the show.
Thank you for calling.
I just want to speak from my experience. I'm in my 40s now. In 1996, I was raided. There were expectations that I would have other drugs and other things, but it was all false. I had less than a quarter of an ounce of marijuana in one bag, no scales, no baggies, no cash. But still, I was used as an example. I was even on CNBC War on Drugs. I was sentenced to Tracy State Prison. I was forced to do a nine-month drug program. At the time this started, I had a business. I had invested my own money in it and was doing good things. And during my stint locked up, I had a guard broke one of my fingers. I had one of my cellmates that was from prison that attempted to kill another inmate. And just horrible things that now I've, beyond being institutionalized and having issues, social issues, I'm a felon. I can't vote. I can't get lots of jobs. And I'm honestly scared by this system. Mm. I would love to get things expunged. But for me to go and communicate with the system, I'm afraid. So, you know, it's been since 96.
Wow.
And chances are I can have that stuff done, but I'm afraid of the system. So that's what I've got for you.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Richard, with your story. We're actually have to go to a break for a minute, but you brought up so many good points, and I'll get Eugene to respond afterwards. Like, how do you deal with this and just the aftermath of your experience? We're speaking with Eugene Jarecki, award-winning writer and director. His latest film is The House I Live In, a documentary about the history and effect of the war on drugs in the United States. 500,000 people locked up for nonviolent crimes. We'll be back after this.
And you're listening to Your Call on KALW. I'm Matt Martin, General Manager here at Local Public Radio with Ali Budner, producer of Your Call, asking for your support for this kind of broadcasting that could only happen here in the San Francisco Bay Area on a listener-supported station like KALW. We have this remarkable film, The House I Live In by Eugene Jarecki, yours for a $120 contribution at KALW.org or 800-525-9917.
Yeah, hi, Matt. I watched this film yesterday, and it was one of the most amazing documentaries that I've ever seen. It really captures the history and the impact of the war on drugs in this country in a way that no other film or book that I've ever seen does. It really shows how this went from a public health issue to a criminal issue to a quote war, and it's an incredible analysis, and it's very poignant too. He covers personal stories, meets all these amazing characters whose lives are impacted by the war on drugs, and it's just an incredible education and a wonderful film. So the number to call to pledge for KALW and also for this film is 1-800-525-9917.
Online at kalw.org. This is the kind of conversation you make possible. A voice like Eugene Jarecki's, someone who grapples with really difficult issues, who comes from a place of conscience and that really tries to do good journalistic work. That's what you support on Your Call when you make a call yourself at 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. We're going back to this program in 20 seconds because we want this conversation to be here. Your support at 800-525-9917 keeps the programming uninterrupted. These kind of conversations on the air, kalw.org. A click is as good as a call. Take a thank you gift if you like, but no matter what, know you are taking part in a valuable public resource.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we will have a conversation with David K. Johnston about his latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. This book is now out in paperback, and then we'll also be talking with David about some of the top stories this week, including Syria. Monday, we'll speak with Marion Nessel about her new book, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're speaking with Eugene Jarecki. He's writer and director of The House I Live In, a documentary film about the history and impact of the war on drugs. A lot of you have probably seen Why We Fight. We did a show about that. He's also made films Reagan, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, and Freakonomics. And the film puts a human face on the war on drugs. $1 trillion, 45 million arrests, 500,000 incarcerated today for nonviolent drug crimes, which has really damaged mostly poor communities across the country. So if you've got a personal short story to share, we'd love to hear from you. If you're involved in trying to change these laws, what do you think would actually work? The prison strike here in California just ended on Thursday, and you could bet that a lot of people who went on strike are in for drug offenses. So what are your thoughts about how to change things? And if you talk to friends about this issue who don't know much about it, how do you talk to them? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Eugene, I think we might have Richard on the line still, but I mean, he was charged in 96 for having less than a quarter ounce of marijuana, and you could hear it in his voice. He's still so deeply affected by his experience.
Well, I mean, this is a scarring, lifelong experience. You know, we're not talking about a small thing here. When you give somebody a felony on their record in an already struggling economy, you write the ticket for the rest of their life. I mean, there's no way around that. It's a very rare person who can transcend the incredible blockade that puts on your chances at progress in this country. We have ban the box movements in several states and cities across this country. Ban the box means you ban the right of employers to have a box on their employment form that you have to tick saying whether you've been convicted of a felony. Because if you have that on sometimes it's even have you just been arrested. If you have that on an employment form, that's the very first thing that the employer, they take all those and throw them in the bin before they even look at the rest. So the person never gets to look at you as a person. They look at you as that fact, which was often meted out to you before you were a person of majority. In other words, we won't let you drive a car. There are movies we won't let you see, but you're perfectly able to get the rest of your life ruined as if you're an adult by the fact that we'll either put you in jail as if you're an adult. Once again, we wouldn't let you watch a scary movie, but we're happy to incarcerate you, or we'll just be a little nicer and will give you a strike on your record, which is effectively an invisible prison box around you, because you're never going to be able to get a conventional job. And before long, you're going to have to make some money. And when you need to make some money, we're going to arrest you and then make it more serious.
And 6 million Americans cannot vote because of felon disenfranchisement laws. What would you say to Richard? Because he said he wants to take part, but he's afraid of the system. So how do you try to make changes when you're so scarred?
Well, I don't want to – I can't make light of Richard's experience because he's directly experiencing it, and I'm just the friend and ally of many people all over the country in Richard's situation, and I don't take lightly any of what they're experiencing that I am not. I will say I think the system's done its worst to him already, in the sense that certainly speaking out and unifying with others and letting his community know and telling the world at large about his experience, particularly because he sounded as if he's Caucasian, particularly as a Caucasian person, which is, you know, a new kind of voice that we're seeing in the drug war, where it was easy for, you know, mainstream non-African American Americans to sort of brush this aside. Oh, it's happening to them, but it's not happening to us. The democratization of the drug war across racial lines needs voices, and it needs voices like Richard's to say, hey, this doesn't just happen to black folks. This is happening to poor folks. Because ultimately, the drug war is an attack on poor people. It happened to have taken the form of poor black people because they were the easy target, both because of the community structures, the ghetto structures that had already been inflicted on African Americans, and also because that's where it was easy to dispatch police to without really costing votes. Because if you disenfranchise black voters, then it becomes even easier to not worry at election time that you've harassed them with your cops all year. So we don't, you know, I live in a white neighborhood, comfortable white neighborhood. I always joke, you know, when I come out my front door, I can barely find a cop when I need one. But of course, if I call one, he's there in a heartbeat. In the black community, or now in increasingly in poor white communities, you walk out your front door in a housing project, you're swimming in cops. Mm. Cops are a daily companion that you have to deal with all the time, unless you need one and there's a shooting going on and you call one, and hours later, somebody just happens to maybe pass by, but you never get a real attention to it. So that kind of disproportionate injustice that's going on all over the country, it has new targets in the poor white community. It has new targets in everyday people who aren't just in the original target groups. Those people need to be vocal, and they need to be less afraid, because speaking out is not what they got arrested for. Speaking out in this country is a long overdue and long atrophied muscle that we all need to exercise, and there can be no excuses about it.
Well, thank you again, Richard, for calling in with your story. We have another caller who wants to talk about the racial dimensions of the drug war. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for this show, and I will be pledging in a moment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I deeply appreciate all of Eugene's work, and I've done some work with a local group that deals with Ban the Box and this whole issue of getting a job once you have a record. And that local group, among others, I'm sure, the one I know of is Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. Mm. And my question for Eugene is, I'd love to hear your insights, Eugene, into a little bit more deeply into the racial dimensions of drug policy and criminalization, both now and historically in the 60s and 70s, because I wonder whether the drug war was a response to the civil rights and black power movements.
Right. You'll see this when you see my film. We go very elaborately into the racial history of our drug laws. And one of the things that we really point out is what one of my main discoveries that I learned was that we've had drug laws in America going back to the 1800s. The first drug law, and they've always had a racial subtext or even a dominant text. In the 1800s, the first drug laws we saw were opium laws that were laws specifically used to target immigrant Chinese communities. Opium was dominantly used by white, middle-aged, usually women in the South at that time, but they were never the target of the opium laws, because the opium laws were only passed in California, not across the country, so very selective there. And not just any kind of opium, it was only smoking opium, which was the delivery system favored by the Chinese. The eating of opium and the other consumptions of opium that were happening in California and all across the country remained legal. So those laws were disproportionately used to harass and target Chinese immigrant populations who were seen as perhaps a threat to American jobs. The next phase we saw were black Americans with whom cocaine was associated at the turn of the 20th century and during Reconstruction, of course, the threat that a black man might pose to jobs or to white communities that feared black people was made more aggravated by linking black people to cocaine. So there were headlines that said, you know, drug-crazed Negroes terrorize southern town and such things. And so we saw that as sort of the next chapter. And the next chapter was the Mexicanization of hemp. Hemp, which had been a beloved crop since the dawn of the Republic, all of a sudden goes through a makeover where it becomes marijuana, a Spanish name, which of course makes it easier to associate it with incoming Mexicans across the border, giving you more license and latitude to be able to stop and harass them. And so we've seen chapter by chapter that the drug laws have had a long history. You ask about the 1960s, and in some sense, the ratcheting up of the drug war, of the drug laws into a drug war, happens right after the 60s. So in many ways, you could see it, as Michelle Alexander does, as a new Jim Crow, a kind of a ratcheting up of racially antagonistic laws of racial control, really. You can see that as the drug war becomes a framework for a massive campaign, nationalized campaign, of attacking the black American community on a whole new front where they had been liberated on previous fronts.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Lisa. We have a related email from Seth in San Jose who says, according to Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, 98.6% of those charged with drug crimes who prosecutors choose to charge at the federal level are black, less than 1% are white. And on that note, why don't we play another clip from the film The House I Live In, a documentary made by today's guest, Eugene Jarecki. And this focuses on this issue of race. And the first voice you hear in this clip is David Simon, creator of The Wire.
The drug war began as a war on dangerous narcotics, at least on its face. You know, you can trace modern drug enforcement back to the early 50s when you started to see the rise of sort of the urban narcotic squads, the NARC.
Government agencies charged with the enforcement of narcotics laws have been able until recently to decrease steadily the number of addicts in the United States.
It was at least plausible as a policy, because the use of dangerous narcotics was truly a counterculture. It was the jazz man's vice. It was in the back alleys. It was furtive. There was no mass marketing. There were no drive-up drug corners. It was a very small percentage of the American population that was engaged in the use of heroin or cocaine.
In the 1950s, as drug use was growing among Americans of all backgrounds, law enforcement became increasingly focused on one group in particular.
Why did you turn the dogs loose on the policeman?
Are you telling me that this happened? Are you asking?
I'm asking, did it happen?
No.
There's a narcotic in there.
Black Mary, born free. At least that's the way it's supposed to be.
There's no question that there was a passion with which the early narcotics enforcement culture pursued black America, even though the addict population was always distinctly biracial.
In the 1960s, drug use grew widespread in America. But for black communities, increasing poverty pushed the sale and use of drugs most often onto the street, making them an even greater target for law enforcement.
By the late 60s, most urban areas had a mass market for drugs. By the 80s, you were really looking at the drive-through window. You were looking at McDonald's. At that point, you can't claim that you're trying to isolate a countercultural phenomenon. You're fighting a war against a whole community.
And that is a clip from The House I Live In, a documentary about the history and impact of the war on drugs in the U.S. And today we're joined by writer and director Eugene Jarecki. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have personal stories about the war on drugs, we'd love to hear from you. If you're working with organizations that are trying to reform sentencing laws, for example, and just change the path that we're on, what tactics are you taking and what do you think is most successful? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. We have an email from a listener in Berkeley who says, again, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, is excellent, pointing out that many but not all of the most important things, especially the racial angle about the so-called war on drugs. Your guest points out that the war has cost more than $1 trillion. What this means is that there are major financial interests for government law enforcement personnel, including their high salaries at every level, for paramilitary supply and prison industrial corporate interests. The war on drugs has become a huge money-making industry in keeping even, and especially marijuana, a drug far less medically and societally harmful than cigarettes and alcohol, illegal. What's your response to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have, a vast and out-of-control industrial machine that has arisen with the war on drugs. Prior to having a war on drugs, when we just had this long history of improvised racist laws of social control, none of those gave birth to an industry. What gave birth to an industry again was Richard Nixon, despite the merit of his policymaking, his rhetoric launched the war on drugs. And as such, it unleashed the dogs of war. And the dogs of war, as we've seen from Iraq and Afghanistan and every other conflict we've wasted blood and treasure on in the last decades, these are giant industrial field days. And what happens is that all kinds of dogs, all kinds of barbarians assemble at the gate to become profiteers. And of course, Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex stands as a kind of a shadow over all this, because what it teaches us is that it's not just the old-school profiteering, which was a gruesome part of the human condition. It's where you see humans a little bit like a hyena who profits off of the lion killing the warthog, and the hyena comes to kind of pick up the pieces and is shameless about that, and somehow seems a little seedy as a character because he doesn't have the nobility to do the kill. He's just lapping up the side effects. And that was always kind of the classic historical image of the war profiteer. No, Eisenhower warned that it would get far worse when the hyena becomes the lion, when the lion takes on the sort of sick sensibility of a hyena without the nobility, which is to say that the hyena thinks to itself, how do I ensure a steady flow of warthogs coming down the pike? Let me influence the public policy-making machine it with lion's power. Let me influence it so that we have more war to make more profit. So the tail begins to wag the dog. And of course, we see that in the conversion of our worry from arms makers to Halliburton. You know, if we look at what the arms makers do, they need war in order to make money. So in theory, they want the threat of war and they're parasites when a war happens. But largely, they just want the preparations for war. A weapons maker doesn't need war. They need the need for war. They need the preparation, the fear of war. And so that changes, however, when you have a company like Halliburton that services war in the field. Now, when they meet with your congressperson, they want war. They don't want the preparation for war. They don't want a wartime footing. They want war. And the same is true of the war on drugs. It made national legitimate it made sort of corruption a nationally legitimate outlet for this country, so that we now have politicians who wake up every morning and what they seek to do is to bring jobs to their district and money to their campaign coffers. And their friends in the prison industrial sector, that means one thing for them. That means that those politicians need to write laws that put more people in prison beds for longer so that all of those profit seekers can make their profits off of them. And that politician who does that will be rewarded with that money in the campaign coffers and with more jobs to the district that he can tell his constituents about. That's the unsavory, unholy, terrible alliance that exists in our political corporate class in this country across industries. But it just has such horrifying results when human life is at stake, as it does here.
And across political parties.
Oh, it's everybody. There's no Republicans and Democrats share the same implication in this. If anything, the Democrats are almost more in a certain way more shady about it because they feed us a lot of rhetoric about human rights and they evoke Kennedy and King and lots of other warm-hearted things while they do the same, while they report to the same paymasters.
All right. Well, thank you again for the emails and the phone call. Let's hear next from Marcia in Santa Cruz. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for bringing this up. And even more insidious than, I mean, added to the whole idea of this economic boom, I really lost my innocence when I learned about the campaign with Nicaragua trying to get the Contras to give us cocaine to import into the black communities. That just shocked me to my core, and I'm wondering if that's addressed in your movie, and if you'd like to talk about that, I'll take my answer
sure.
off the air.
It is glaringly not addressed in my movie. And for no other reason than just time and what I felt the movie could focus on, that is a story of such depraved darkness in the American – it's such a stain on America's history. The active work by the U.S. government to flood the inner cities with drugs that could then become the pretext for stopping, frisking, arresting, seizing, and incarcerating members of the black community. So this is a fact of history. People should look up Gary Webb, who was the journalist at the San Jose Mercury Mercury News, who broke this story before his death. Also look at the work of Charles Bowden, and also there are several other writers who've written about this. Consortiumnews.com, which is Robert Perry's website. Robert Perry also did a lot of work on this. So there are several journalists who've dealt with that issue, and yes, it's one of the harrowing chapters I don't deal with in the movie. A, for time, and to be perfectly honest with you, because in a movie like mine that's trying to reform a grotesque episode unfolding today, mine is not just a survey film. It was a film designed to try to bring about the kind of changes that I'm proud to say we're seeing. I didn't want to pick a fight with people who would literally not believe that story, that they would just find it so out there that I'd have a debate with them about whether it was a conspiracy theory or not, instead of getting to the practical matters that really will affect lives today. And frankly, that one doesn't. It sheds light on just how depraved we have been, but we're not doing that now exactly. We're doing all of the other NSA things and all the rest. We're not doing that now, so I didn't want to pick a fight that I wasn't going to spend 20 minutes of screen time to prove. And so it's not in the film. It is in some of the work we do with our extras and the website and DVD.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Marcia. And we're speaking with Eugene Jarecki, writer and director of The House I Live In. What you did do in the film, and what I really appreciated, is you talked about poverty and how what role this plays. And you also went back and looked at just how children are brought up, what their personal situation is like. And I want to ask you, after we play this clip, when we're talking about reforming these laws, how do you also get society and politicians to focus on the issue of poverty, because that's so big here? And in this clip, you will hear former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, Jonathan Kaufman with The Wall Street Journal, David Simon, creator of The Wire, former President Bill Clinton, and again, Michelle Alexander.
Very interesting. People ask the question, what about personal responsibility?
The only thing you don't do is blame criminals for the crime that they committed. You blame everybody else and everything else.
You know, I wish the answer were that simple, but let's just take a little step back. There are structural impediments. What you see over and over again in urban America are kids who live in a crowded home, who are hungry when they go to school, who lack attention because they've heard noise and gunshots and other things where they live.
I don't think people fully understand. In the inner city, these kids are making rational choices. I profiled a girl who was like this, a 10-year-old girl. The minute she steps out her front doorway, there are drug dealers out there. No economic opportunity. The school is warehousing her. She doesn't see any prospects. How is she supposed to get out?
At the end of the day, when there's not a lot of resources out here and your teachers aren't stressing you to come to class or not even caring, you know, you're not going to go to school. You're going to sell drugs. You're going to do what you have to do.
To go down to a drug corner in the inner city is the rational act of somebody going to work for the only company that exists in a company town. When that is the only economy that's functioning in certain places in this country, what do we expect?
Beyond the structural barriers that promote drug crime on the street, those arrested soon find themselves in a self-perpetuating cycle from which few ever really escape.
People don't realize, for example, that when you arrest a young black man and he goes to jail, the first thing, when he gets out of the prison, he can't get a job in most places because of his record.
If you have a felony charge, you need to be working. You need to be trying to move yourself forward.
If he wants to go back to school to go to college, he's ineligible by law for certain grants.
Medical issues, if you have any.
He can't get certain health care benefits. He can't live in certain neighborhoods. His family that was the centerpiece of his life, if they're living in public housing, they can't take him in.
The only people who deserve to live in public housing are those who live responsibly there.
He can't vote.
Release from prison offers this idea that you're going to return to some kind of freedom, but in reality, for the rest of your life, you've got to check that box on employment applications, asking that dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? It becomes a vicious circle in which people cycle out of their ghetto communities into prison and back.
That's a clip from The House I Live In, a documentary about the war on drugs by Eugene Jarecki, today's guest. Eugene, how do we also bring these issues to people's attention? Because, you know, so many of these problems go back to poverty.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the classic ruse that's been sort of perpetrated in all this, is that by criminalizing drug addiction, what we did was to stigmatize it so that people sort of talk about the drug user or the drug dealer as an evildoer, just like we did this with 9/11. You know, we're not supposed to think that anyone might have a complaint against the United States, even crazy people who do horrible things. We're supposed to assume that they hate our freedoms or some other nonsense. The reality is that everybody knows that America's reputation around the world has been left very open to question. America has aligned itself with some of the terrible despots of the last century. We have found ourselves on the wrong side of history in so many ways that it fertilizes the ground for the recruitment of upset people, even by crazy people, and so who do have terrible and fanatical goals. I say that because the same sort of minimization of what might be warranted in a discussion of the wrongdoing of America, so much of which has been borne out in the last 10 or 12 years, we know so much more about why the world is upset with America than we did a decade ago. The same is true here. You know, we vilified the drug users, so we never asked, why is the person using drugs? But if we had a member of our family who got addicted to something, we wouldn't immediately blame them and be angry at them. We certainly wouldn't make our first call to the cops. We'd try to figure out how to intervene with compassion, with medicine, with science, with common sense. But what we've instead done is to really sort of criminalize an entire facet of the human condition. Addiction is a common reality among all people. I have addictions. Mine just happen not to be illegal. You know, I overeat. There are carbohydrate addictions. There's addictions to shopping, to gambling, to sex, to everything under the sun. And yet, you know, those don't have a criminal price tag attached to them. And arbitrarily, and I say very arbitrarily, we did that here. And what we do when we do that is most often we give ourselves a get-out-of-jail-free card on the rest of our social sins.
David, I have to cut you off because we're almost out of time, but I just want to find out what would you change in just about 30 seconds, major changes?
I would absolutely overhaul this the way the country of Portugal has done. Any of your listeners should Google Portugal, which 10 years ago legalized all drugs across the board and left penalties for serious dealers. But use and possession stopped being a matter of criminal law, and it became a matter of public health in Portugal. AIDS rates went down, drug use among the young went down, drug-related violence went down, and of course the criminal justice workload plummeted with a huge savings, and they used just part of that to make the most robust treatment system in the world. So instead of being the laughingstock of the world as we are now, we could get out ahead of this as Portugal has done. So public health should replace the drug war.
Eugene Jarecki, writer and director of The House I Live In, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
And having listened to this hour with Eugene Jarecki, I'm Matt Martin, general manager of KALW, joining Rose in the studio on this first day of our September membership campaign, which we are keeping short, just 7 days. But that means each day, each hour counts. We're asking for your support right now at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Join the people like David Kramer in Albany, Jennifer Strauss in San Mateo, Kevin Perkins in San Carlos, who've called or clicked 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
Thank you. For a $120 donation, we will send you The House I Live In, an excellent documentary about the war on drugs. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org. Your support makes these conversations happen. And we got such a great response today, Matt.
In fact, I
already have some show ideas because a lot of people say, my friend got 20 years for this. What can I do to help him? That's why we need independent local public radio. 800-525-9917. $120 will send you this film. You can share it with everyone you know. As Eugene said, this is getting a lot more attention now, but still a lot of people don't know how deep this goes. You can change that. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org.
We need a space for these kind of voices, a critical voice like Eugene Jarecki. And, you know, he goes and tells the real stories, puts it in a powerful form that cuts through people's sense of like, oh, that's somebody else's problem. And then to have a space like this where in your call, where we can take a call like Richard in Monterey.
Yeah.
You know, you hear the human impact of the drug war in his voice. Your support keeps that space open. 800-525-9917. Thanks to the folks who are on the line right now. You can also go to KALW.org if that's easier for you.
800-525-9917. We attempt to bring in the human element whenever we do shows because it's often missing in the national media, and that angle is so important. So support that kind of radio. 100% of our show is funded directly by you, and we could not do this without you. $120 will send you The House I Live In. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org.
Got a quote here. here from a listener who went into KALW.org, gave their support, says, I like the non-interrupting format of the pledge drive. Plus, I believe KALW provides great programming that presents other sides of issues. Your call is one such program that I love to listen to. Thank you so much for that support.
Thank you.
800-525-9917. We are going to be going to the BBC in just a moment, so give your support now.
I almost forgot that we're doing Shorter is Better because it's just the way that we're doing it now. 800-525-9917 or online KALW.org. Every contribution helps us stay local and independent. 800-525-9917 or online KALW.org.
Thanks
for your support.
And for listening to KALW San Francisco.